You're on.
KCIW Curry Matters continues our conversations with community leaders. This is the second in a series about the sheriff's proposed levy. Today we are on site at the jail for a jail tour. The sheriff has made the generous offer for citizens to have jail tours, so KCIW has decided to take Sheriff John Ward up on his offer. I'm Connie Hunter. Joining me today are Sheriff John Ward, Lieutenant Michael Mick Espinoza, and Sergeant Joel Hensley, along with the KCIW crew of co-interviewers Jan Barbas and Jim Newman. Jan and Jim have both been great as co-producers today, and they also handle the technical equipment. Everyone, feel free to participate in the conversation and ask questions as they come up. A special note, Jan Barbas sits on both the Sheriff's Citizens Advisory Committee and the KCIW Board of Directors. We're going to start off with some introductions, a few questions, then take the jail tour, and then ask a few more questions. Let's start with a brief intro of our guest, and Sheriff John Ward's just going to give us a brief intro, and then he's got other work to do, and he's going to go on with his day. So, John, please tell us a bit about yourself and priorities of the new sheriff in Curry County.
Hi, like I said, this is Sheriff John Ward, and I was appointed sheriff on October 1st to replace outgoing Sheriff John Bishop. Our main priorities were to figure out a way to permanently fund our sheriff's office so we're not scratching from year to year, figuring out where the next dollar's coming from, and being able to retain our employees and our experience. And so it's our hope that we would provide permanent funding through a special law enforcement district. So we decided to get with the citizens of the community who would like to be on a citizens advisory board, and we decided to work on a plan to form the district. And that's where we are now. We've had many meetings, and we've come up with the solution that we cannot put the district on this May's ballot like we initially thought we could, do the timelines and regulations. So it was decided that a 3-year local option levy for sheriff's office functions only would have to be presented to the voters to vote on. And that's where we are. We've come up with an agreement on a split rate, and we've been keeping the Board of Commissioners all involved in that. And that's where we are now. So like Connie said, that I'm working on that actually this afternoon, and I'm going to let my lieutenant, Mike Espinoza, take over from here, along with the jail commander, Sergeant Joel Hensley.
Thank you, Sheriff. We appreciate your hard work on behalf of the citizens of Curry County.
Thank you. And if you need anything further, you know, I'll be just down the hall.
All right, then. Thanks so much. And Lieutenant Michael Mick Espinoza, please tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, I'm the operations lieutenant with the Curry County Sheriff's Office. My responsibilities are to oversee the patrol, corrections, 911, and search and rescue and marine patrol operations. Basically, that entails just making sure that all our daily operational needs are being taken care of, that we're taking care of the community's expectations for the sheriff's office, and working as second in command to Sheriff John Ward. Aside from that, I've had 23 years of law enforcement experience. I've worked in various capacities to include as a patrol deputy, patrol supervisor in the ranks of sergeant, lieutenant. I've also worked in the ranks of as a commander, a jail captain. I've had experience working in investigations as an investigating supervisor and lieutenant during a period of time. Currently I have an executive certification with the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training for management level police executive operations. I'm also a graduate of the FBI National Academy, class number 248, and a graduate of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association Supervisors Command College, so I've had some of that background as well.
Wow, I didn't know all those things about him, Mick. I'm even more impressed with your service. Sergeant Joel Hensley, nice to meet you. Please tell us a little bit about yourself.
I'm honored to be here. Sergeant Joel Hensley, Curry County Sheriff. Worked for the agency for over 16 years. Started off as a corrections deputy for about 3 years. Then I transferred to patrol. While I was in patrol, I had a couple years as in investigations. Handled those up until about 2007 with Detective Dave Gardner. Then went due to layoffs back to patrol, where I served up until Sheriff Ward promoted me to jail commander in early part of November, late last part of October. I hold currently advanced police certificate. I have been authorized for dual certification, which means I'll have a both correction certificate and a police certification. I have attended the Sheriff Command College in 2013, and it's been my pleasure to serve the citizens of Curry County.
Thank you both for your service, and let's get on with the interview. We've got a lot to cover. Can you give me a little background for our listeners about the general details about the county jail, including some of the info about day-to-day operations? What's it like here?
Yeah, I'm going to let Sergeant Hensley, if he's okay with that, do that, because that's what his function is, the day-to-day details and how he oversees that and how he manages the staff. So I think it's important to hear from a frontline supervisor the expectations and what it takes to actually get those details accomplished.
Sure, not a problem. Here at the jail, we have currently 25 beds available. Those are housed by different varying people accused or have been convicted of certain crimes. We don't keep anybody on a violation. Violations are your speeding tickets, stuff like that. These are actually crimes that are punishable by time in jail. Our day-to-day operations is we like to have it somewhat structured, but of course, since we're in emergency operations, it flows, ebbs and flows. It'll be super busy, but then we'll have some time periods of some breaks. But the morning for a normal daily operation between Monday through Friday, we have court that my staff's usually. I have no more than three on as corrections deputies. I have a total of 12 employed that I'm in charge of. And they're every morning they have to prepare a court docket. They have to get the prisoners over to court to be seen. I also have to make time for their attorneys to come over and see them. That has to occur sometimes in the morning starting at 8:30. There's arraignments, and from there is normal court docket. So we have to review the docket, take the inmates back and forth, make sure that we have all the correct documentation, make sure we have the people held here for the appropriate amount of time. Sentencing is done. My staff is responsible for computing that, making sure we don't hold somebody longer than they're supposed to be or release them prior to that. All throughout that's the morning time. Then we go into lunch from there. That's from about 11 o'clock. We have certain regulatory times that everything has to stop for meal times. Meal times are regulated through the Oregon Jail Standards. We only have a certain amount of time that they're allowed to be unfed. And where that comes into play is between our meal time at night at 5 o'clock to our breakfast morning time at 6 in the morning or 7 in the morning. They cannot go longer than that time period of, I think it's 14 hours off the top of my head, that we can't allow meal times to go beyond that. We have a dietitian that's in charge of our food and through a contractor, which actually saves us a lot of money. Before, we only had inmates preparing the food, but portion size wasn't controlled. Our dietary concerns may not have been being met. Now we know they are. Our meals are being all reviewed by a dietitian. We know that inmates are receiving the appropriate amount of food that they need to receive. And also, whenever people don't take care of their bodies, they usually sometimes through substance abuse, drug abuse, alcohol abuse, they'll have weakened livers, kidneys, or just overall wellness. If we aren't careful of what we feed them, we can overload those certain organs. It can cause kidney failure, it can cause liver failure, it can cause other enzyme problems, it can cause stomach problems. So that's all part of the food service that we still have to provide. So that takes us to about noon. And from noon, we'll still be processing people that come back from court, any new arrests throughout the day. The arrests we take as they come. We kind of have to almost stop everything, go down, take care of the arrest. The officer has to provide us with a sworn statement of why the person is here. It's up to my staff's responsibility. One, make sure that it is the elements of a crime are there. And two, it's an actual crime punishable by jail time that somebody can hold somebody here in Curry County. So they're responsible for doing that. They have the officer swear to them on that form. So we can present that to a judge and district attorney later. Continues through the day. My staff is still responsible for every hour, inspecting every inmate. They have to go see them, talk to them, see what's going on. We still have to take care of the needs of all inmates inside the facility. And those needs vary from being able to contact legal counsel to needing more toothpaste. There are things that we allow our inmates to have, soap, toothpaste, toothbrush, that kind of stuff will refill while they're here, so that they can have some way, I mean, take care of their personal hygiene. That'll take us till dinner time. After dinner time, it's still processed throughout the day. We do linen and clothing exchange twice a week. We give them fresh clothes, also all fresh new linens. If they end up soiling something, but in the meantime, staff always exchanges it out. They just have to present one to get one. Then from there, we allow visitation two times a week. So that takes up about 4 hours on Sunday. I'm shooting from the hip here. About another, I think, 3 hours on Wednesdays in the evening time. So we have to stop other operations. We can't let other jail movements be happening while visitation's occurring, because we still have to monitor which inmates are going to the visitation center at one time. There is no contact visits in Curry County. It's all strictly through about a 6x6 inch piece of glass and a telephone headset. So my staff is having to monitor the lobby traffic, see what's going on, make sure that we don't have a potential for contact between people that can't be together, or other violence or other crimes occurring out there.
If I cut in real quick.
Yeah, go ahead, sir.
You know, a lot of what Joel, Sergeant Hensley, is describing is basically it's like running a mini city. The importance for a county jail to be understood is this, is that we get people at their worst. We get people off the street right after they committed a crime. Generally, they're intoxicated with some controlled substance or alcohol. We also get people who are mentally ill or mentally disturbed and have committed a crime, so they have to be assessed. So everything that the sergeant just talked to you about, you know, he makes it sound very simplified because that's what they do on a daily basis. But in reality, when you think about having to take people to court for their first arraignment and the fact that they're coming down from controlled substances and maybe have made a terrible life choice, what kind of reaction are they going to have? What kind of reaction are the family or victims going to have in the courtroom? That's a very dangerous place. We've seen that on national news time and time again where violence has been in those areas. So we have to worry about that. But we got two or three deputies on, as noted. Then we have mandatory things. Once per hour, we have to go by and make sure everybody's okay. And believe it or not, we have people who do not want to be here. So we'll have fights. We'll have mental folks who have done something, soiled themselves, soiled the cell. And, you know, they don't play well with others. So we have to take time to deal with that. You have to enter that court paperwork. That court paperwork is so vital, so essential to the entire criminal justice system. That lets us know, lets others know where we are in the process. And then, you know, the staff have to have that unique touch, that ability to calm people down, keep good order in there, and good cleanliness, sanitation. So everything the sergeant described for you is like running a mini city. We use our inmates to help prepare food. What does that do? It cuts down on costs for the citizens. We use our inmates to do laundry and linen exchange. What's that do? Again, cuts down on staff time, cuts down on us having to do that. We use them in those functions. And at the same time, we do try to provide some inmate programming through the week. You know, that's a good thing to do, but it's also disruptive to normal operations in terms of movements, in terms of, you know, can this guy be with that guy or can that lady be with this lady? So you're constantly on edge with that. And what gets overlooked a lot is we constantly review the status of every inmate in here. You cannot put certain people with other people because there is a imminent threat of danger or harm. And based on that, that's our responsibility and liability. So that jail is a huge liability. You know, I'll use an example of a daycare. You know, when you drop your child off the daycare, you leave them there. You expect them to come out, you know, safe, happy, and healthy. Well, we take similar pains to do that. We have minimum staffing levels, but we want to make sure that they're medically cared for properly, they're monitored properly, that they're safe from others, they're safe from themselves, and that means a risk for us. But we also have to be very cognizant of what they are, who they are, where we put them. So all these things get factored into what he was just describing for you.
And mentioning, you know, the liability and responsibility to the inmate, when you have somebody come in with prescription medications like for hypertension, diabetes, glaucoma, that kind of stuff, do you have somebody on staff that is versed in that, or do you have a relationship with the hospital staff to help interface?
We have a contract with the nursing staff, and so it depends on the medication. You know, staff get pretty good about, you know, what the meds should be, but generally the protocol is this, that those meds come in, we contact the nursing staff, and we're only taking in life-sustaining meds or meds that are really necessary to make that person, you know, healthy. We don't try to bring in a myriad of meds or medications.
Well, and we've had times where unfortunately, someone will go to the doctor and obtain two or three different prescriptions. And so whenever they come into our custody, they've either rounded them all up, or they've, you know, or through doctor shopping, they've done these things. And our staff...
The shoebox routine.
Correct. Absolutely. So our medical staff, my jail staff, gives them all the information, and my nurse can break it down to, well, this will interact poorly with this. So you can't have this if you have this. And so I got to get more medical records. And then, you know, she can contact medical, their constant doctor, and figure out what's going on. That's one thing that's always
caught. We think it's important. I can tell you, from my standpoint, you know, it's important for us to provide life-sustaining medications, medications that are necessary for that person's, you know, daily life functions to be met. But at the same time, we're cognizant, and this is a financial responsibility, not to over-provide medications for people that are, you know, been doctor shopping, as the sergeant mentioned, on the outside, and then all of a sudden have all these ailments, or they want to bring them in and get things fixed. We got to be, you know, there's a fine line there between what's a have to have and what's a like to have.
Okay. So, Jan Barbas, let me come in a little. So the jail was built when?
About. I didn't know this was going to be a history test.
sometime around the Jurassic period.
Yeah. I would shoot from the hip and say late 60s, early 70s was the actual build time. But the jail itself, though, is even... I won't tell you what year I was born, but even then, it was an outdated system, I believe, for what it is now. It's an old concrete. It's called a linear style jail. The jails now are either direct supervision or non-direct, and that also has another meaning. It's a podular system is what a lot of places use, where they have a large day room area. Then off of that is separate cells that all look into the day room area. So you can still have a large area for everybody to interact and do programs, religious services. I mean, the list is so much more capable than what we have here.
So when we go into this jail, we're going to see linear hallways.
Correct.
Doors off of them.
Right. Correct.
I think the rooms, the cells, have no natural light.
That's right. None. And the thing with the linear, too, just as you'll notice, it's more staff intensive, whereas a lot of the podular style or the styles where you have staff actually in there reduces the amount of staff that you would need for the number of inmates. This is more staff intensive.
And I think it puts you guys, our employees, our county employees, your staff, at more risk, and there's some additional fire hazard and risk to the inmates as well. Is that, am I understanding that correct?
No, I think anytime you have people incarcerated, there's risk. Mm-hmm. You know, we try to reduce the fire risk, obviously, with, you know, our yearly inspections with the fire marshal and whatnot. I don't want to say we're running a facility that has all these hidden risks that we're just bypassing. What happens is that when you have buildings that have gone so long without upgrades, or you haven't had the financial ability to make necessary upgrades in security equipment or different fire suppression equipments, then you run a risk of, yeah, if you have an issue, how will this older system hold up in comparison to newer ones? So, you know, we do get annual inspections. We do have things, you know, to provide safety mechanisms. But if you ask me, I think there's more risk in this jail, the way it's designed and associated with how the cell designs are, how we house people, and not having the ability to have specialized cells for people with mental health issues, those who have, you know, thoughts of harming themselves, those who are, you know, aggressive towards others. Those are things right there that I would consider huge risk to not only the inmates but the staff as well.
And you have to go into these dorm cells and interact with the prisoners more. Is that something?
Yeah, you know, it's not more, but it's a mandate. You know, once an hour, you have to go by and do physically see people. Mm-hmm. You know, and make sure that they're okay. That's at once every hour for 24 hours, and we should be doing more. And we do more random, you know, than routine searches and cell inspections. So we do go in there and interact with them. That's what we expect. That's the unique thing about corrections, is that our staff have to go in there and they'll interact with people who have a complete mental disability to someone who's very high-functioning, articulate, but at the same time very manipulative. And you've got to run a blend of, you know, who you're dealing with and what the situation is. So they become sort of unique professionals on their own.
Well, and with our cell design, like you're alluding to, Jan, they are small. And really, it's hard to, if you have someone in there that is trying to harm themselves or damage property or even assault a staff member, it's hard to get more than two people in there to handle that situation. And so I know from my past history of having to work the jail and being in enforced situations, I've become injured just because of the cell design itself. It's very small. I mean, I ended up with busted hands, you know, just trying to put somebody into restraints. It is very labor intensive. Everything here is old turnkey. So we have the Folger Adams keys, which you see in the old Western movies. So we got to open up a door, let somebody out, open up another door, close that door, open this door to a hall. Then we can go down that hall to an open door. We do have a command and control structure here for the jail, but when it comes to interior operations, it's all turnkey operation. So to move one inmate to visit with his attorney, it's a couple minutes procedure for one full staff member. Now, where I will say that I wish I need more staff to be here to make sure my staff is safe is that whenever I do have my deputy over in court with four or five inmates and he's doing his court document, then I have a fight breakout here. I need to know that my other staff members here are safe and they have the adequate backup they need. There's been situations where there's different situations going on in separate areas of the jail population. So if I have two guards here, they could be tied up on the north end and one could be tied up in the central end, both on separate instances, but they're alone.
How many incidences would you say is normal over a period of time, a week, a month?
You get them daily. It's just how do you want to classify the incident?
Yeah.
I mean, you have incidents daily where someone's upset over, you know, they came back from court and they didn't get the result they wanted. Somebody's mad because staff didn't give them the answer they wanted. Inmates are fighting, you know. And so, you know, there's, you know, incidents are defined through various, you know, terms. You have assaults on staff, assaults on inmates.
I just read one today. It was an incident report that happened yesterday where an inmate here, they're trying to move him from our holding area to more permanent housing situation, didn't want to go. He ended up just refusing. They had to use minimal amount of force, but they were able to get him to start to comply with their instructions. But then he ended up throwing water on two of my staff members and threatening a Brookings police officer with knowing where his family lives. But that was just something that happens throughout
that's every,
the day.
Yeah, we get bookings throughout the day, and every booking is an incident, in my opinion, because, again, you're evaluating a person at their worst, and 9 out of 10 times they come in intoxicated or high, which makes it very difficult to have a logical conversation with that person. So you've got to constantly monitor that. We'll have issues with that.
Last year alone, we had 1,246 bookings here at the jail.
That's quite a high number. I'm really impressed with the background that you're giving us, but let's move ahead and go out to the tour, and we've got some questions after the tour. I'm sure we'll come up with more while we're involved. Just so you know, KCIW Curry Matters continues our conversations with community leaders, and we're headed for the jail tour. Thanks, gentlemen. From our tour, I was not only impressed, but my eyes were open about the cost effectiveness and the strategies and the professionalism of the staff. And we're going to go on with a few more questions, continuing our conversation. What is the Sheriff's Office currently doing to overcome challenges? I know you guys have a number of them, so list a few, and what are you doing about it?
Our biggest challenge right now facing us today, I think everybody knows, is how do we financially fund a fully functional and operational Sheriff's Office? The funding that we have currently is not enough. It's not stable enough. I've used the term, it's patchwork. It's not just one stable source that's identified for our organization so that we can build an organization and a culture within that organization that best serves the community. So that's the biggest issue we have going right now. After that is, you know, with instability is how do you bring in quality staff? How do you maintain quality staff? You know, our staff is the most important and most vital resource we have. But in order for them to grow, in order for them to stay with us, we have to be able to provide them adequate training, you know, adequate funds, you know, payment, and then in a good working environment, equipment, things of that nature. So we have to overcome those things right up front. And I think the best way to overcome that is what we're doing right now, a grassroots effort, working with the community. You know, I'm honored to work with the Sheriff's Advisory Board, those who volunteer on that board who bring their efforts on their own time to help us get the word out to the community and educate the community on it. Isn't that we just want to add numbers and we want to do more patrol. It's that we want to do better in our jail and our jail operation. We want more efficiency. We want 24/7 patrol covers throughout the entire county. Rural patrols, sheriff's office patrols are much different than any other patrols. We want to be a member partner in our communities. You know, we want to do better in how we deliver our civil papers, mandatory paperwork. We want to do better in our search and rescue efforts, our Marine Patrol. But we can't do that until we have stabilized funding, the ability to go out and recruit good quality personnel and then maintain them and train them and get them used to the meeting the expectations of the voters of Curry County or the citizens of Curry County. And that's exactly what we want. Right now, we're working on two different sheets of paper. We have expectations. The public has that expectation, but I want us to meet on one sheet of paper, and that is that we will be fiscally responsible with those funds that they provide us, and we will provide the best in public safety services day in and day out, and they have a voice in how that happens. And we want to invite them to constantly give us evaluations on that. Coming up, if we're able to put this levy on the ballot, that's an evaluation, in my opinion, of what people think about the services we provide. And so it's important for us to educate them and be prepared to provide them with a quality service.
So today in the jail, what is the level of experience and staffing, and how are the folk in the jail, the staff in the jail, doing, you know?
Well, what I have in the jail right now is I have one employee that has over 17 years worth of experience. Then from there, it's about 2.5 years or less for the rest of my remaining 11 jailers. We just graduated two from the academy, and in another week we're going to be sending another one to the academy. Finding that we've just cycled through a lot of people, not so much that we've terminated them, but they've come, got trained, and gone elsewhere, been approached by other agencies, and was scooped up. So it's hard to retain people. I had a staff member tell him that he's not taking any days off because he wants to save up his time. So if he does get laid off, he would be able to cash in his vacation check to be able to provide for him and his son. As being a manager, I don't like hearing that. I want my people to know that we are safe and secure here, that this here, he knows that this will be here for him unless he chooses to leave. I can't tell him that. All the interview boards, Lieutenant Espinosa and I are, number one question asked at the very end of every potential employee we've interviewed, how stable would my job be? And we tell them point blank what we're facing.
And you know what's interesting about that too is you got to think about it in these ways. These are living wage jobs. So not only are we're recycling the money really in the community, because these people come, they either buy or rent homes, they have families, their kids go to school, they will contribute, you know, to the overall funds, they'll shop locally, they'll live locally. Most of our hires recently have been local people who grew up in this community. They want to serve the community. So it's kind of a win-win if we're able to get, you know, stabilized in that way, because we will have living wage jobs for folks instead of taking away living wage jobs. And that's another area that just really frustrates me, is why give away the opportunity to provide, because that's what creates a stable and healthy community.
So if the jail were to close, for instance, we'd be giving those jobs to Coos County or Josephine County or something like that?
Absolutely.
And tell us, so right now the jail is grandfathered. Sheriff is not asking for a new jail at this time. It's not included in the levy proposal. Only operations are in the levy proposal. What does grandfathered mean, and what would happen if our jail did close?
Well, here's what I'll tell you. The jail, you cannot close a jail. It's a mandatory function. I mean, we could reduce it down to bare minimums, but right now we are failing to meet certain standards within the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. We're failing to meet certain federal standards with regard to how a jail is supposed to be functional or operational with certain aspects. And if we were to reduce it down to the very bare minimum and then say, okay, we're going right back up or we're going to add the beds back, I'm sure that someone would step in and say, no, the things that you have are inadequate to run that operation the way it is. So they would want you to modernize it. They'd want you to bring it up to code, and that would be akin to building a new jail. I mean, we're going to spend twice as much to reduce it down to the bare minimum and then try to bring it back as it is to maintain it right now and make it functional.
Well, and the some of the standards that were grandfathered in means the facility itself was built prior to the standard being a mandate across the board. So like I showed you the fire suppression or lack of fire suppression in the cell areas. We have solid concrete above, solid concrete below, solid concrete walls. It's not like we can just pipe water in for a fire suppression unit. We have been grandfathered in that those haven't been shut down by the fire marshal for housing because we haven't done any new construction and we can't. ADA, Americans with Disabilities Act, our doorways are not big enough to fit a wheelchair. There's only two doors in that entire facility we can get a wheelchair through and that's it. Neither one of them are housing units. So if we had somebody that was bound to be here, we'd have to work on an arrangement with another facility, pay them to house that person while they're here. The Prison Rape Elimination Act, or PREA, I spoke of back there, where we have to protect inmates from having to see or be subject to someone's nudity, using the toilet, using the shower. That's something where I told you I'd probably have to develop a plan, even presenting it knowing that we don't have the funds for it because it's a mandate that we are required to do. The mental health holding areas, we don't have a place to be able to hold somebody who's self-injurious. Showed you the restraint chair. It's something we don't like to use. However, somebody is self-injurious to the point that we can't stop them from hurting themselves, we will have to use the restraint chair. It's a total 7-point harness system to be able to keep people from injuring themselves or causing damage. Those are all things that, yeah, we need here, and that right now we don't have to do it, but if we do close the facility, we cannot reopen it due to those things not being in place.
Let's talk about PREA just a little bit more. I think you showed us a loss of 4 beds because of PREA in the maximum, 5 maximum cells, but down to 6 beds, I think. Is that correct?
You're close, Jan, but it's just because your numbers are off, but that's all. We have North Wing, which is a total of 5. Those 5, they used to hold 10. We reduced it to 5. When the other area was MAC, which is 1 through 4, we reduced those, so we had a total of 9 beds that were lost. However, that was for the under the PREA, the Prison Rape Elimination Act, where we were having 2 men be in a cell, very close quarters. You saw how small that area was, and where the urinal was located for somebody to do their daily business, for lack of a better term, was literally in direct view, sight and sound of the person in that cell with them. There's no way for them to go for privacy, and that is direct violation of PREA. Also with the showering there, we don't do the facility design. There's no way for them to dry off in an area where they can have some privacy and not subject others to the nudity.
There's a classification issue too within that PREA where there are certain people you cannot house with others because they don't play well with them. We have some high-risk individuals, so you need to have them for individualized cells. And, you know, doing the math, you know, if you said, well, you had 50 beds, well, that doesn't mean 50 beds are always available. If you have someone with a mental health issue, they're occupying a cell with 2 beds, well, you don't have 50. Or if you have someone who's sick occupying a cell with 2, you know, so there's some catch-22s, and well, just because you could fit 50 beds doesn't mean that's the best thing to do. So we try to reduce it down not only for economic savings, but so that we can have the best operations we can efficiently for staff and the inmate population that we house, because that's our responsibility for them.
Well, and one thing really quick that we keep talking about the 50-bed facility, I will go out there and say that even when we were at 50 beds, it was never truly a 50-bed facility. They were counting the holding areas, as you saw, as a housing area. That's not appropriate. Our visitation floor is being a housing area, no. Our other cell-in areas is being a housing area, no. So that's what you're looking at is true numbers.
And I know Connie wants to get in here pretty quick, but as well, you closed a cell downstairs that was a former women's dorm, which I think, if I understand, had sheetrock walls. Yep. Is that correct?
Yes.
That wasn't a PREA issue, but that was it was not a
safety and security issue. We recognized that there was water damage, heavy water damage that had the potential to get worse. That there was a myriad of issues in there that I can list, but the smartest thing to do was to close that down, because not only was that going to be a monetary issue to maintain, but we were creating a liability in there because if something did burst or break, we have people laying underneath that. Well, again, we're responsible for that.
And then my staff was split between 2 floors. I would have to have a staff member downstairs, staff member upstairs, and I mean it was so hard to manage, and it's. Our liability has been so reduced by bringing the female dorm back up here.
Connie?
sorry to switch gears on you real quick, but as a veterans advocate, I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't ask a little bit about veterans and how you handle veterans populations and the relationship with the VA and community services available to veterans. Could you elaborate on that for me?
I've been in contact with, I lost her name. She's a veterans outreach. She's talked about bringing in an iPad. I did have a technical question because I want to make sure it can only contact the VA, but they'll use like a Skype type technology so where she can be in her office, be able to provide veterans with services. A lot of it is helping them getting into treatment for drug and alcohol. Right now, there's an inmate I've been assisting on the outside that he started off in here with this communication because he's tired of that lifestyle. Another inmate's in here right now. We're hoping to have him on board to be able to do that. And it's we don't have this technology now, but she has come by. We've talked. I've provided her phone information. She's been able to get forms to be able to help the inmates here and speak on their behalf. She's been a good resource for me. She reached out to me and helped me out. Being a new commander, I was unfamiliar with services besides our local veteran services representative, Tony
Bowdy.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had experience with that in the past, you know, and again, through stable funding, you know, it was in command of a facility where we did have a computer where we allowed them to Skype. We would ask classifications of all persons booked into the facility, and if they were a veteran, then we asked additional questions, and they were allowed to Skype with the veteran services, and it was in Portland, and we ran as a pilot project, and what they did is they determined if they can get them resources, housing, medications, you name it, and then that also helped with a decision, a release decision for them. Maybe it could be earlier or later, but they wouldn't just get out and be left alone.
In terms of managing jail populations, I know mental health court exists. I, of course, advocate for a veterans court as well. What are your feelings about that end of the spectrum? And not to go too long with that, but
I'll take a quick stab at it. We need both.
Okay.
There's no doubt we need both. Both are a unique situation. I feel very strongly, especially for the mental health folks, not that they're any different than veterans, but when their crimes are nuisance crimes and you or I would be released or get the proper ability to be released and not held, but a mental person is being held because there's nowhere else for them, I think that's improper. I think it's unconstitutional. I think it's my job to fight for them or help advocate for them. As for the veterans, yeah, they've fought for us to lose insurance and benefits. Just by the fact they've committed a crime doesn't mean that they didn't serve our country. So I think it's important that we still recognize that and try. And a lot of the things that they're doing are based on that service. So maybe let's get them to a specialized court with people who can recognize that and treat some of that.
I agree wholeheartedly with that. That's exactly what's needed. Strong mental health court would be so nice. Have a inmate that we have completely... He's come and gone through that risk assessment system that I told you guys about in the facility for overcrowding situation. He would get released even though he hasn't done his sentence. We just got new information today that it might be a mental health issue. So I had him forward me the information. Hopefully I can get mental health rolling on that because he hasn't outwardly shown any signs of being mentally ill. However, we've got some potential family member that came forward and says, hey, here's some information. So we're going to run with that and hopefully get him some services, get mental health over here, maybe do an evaluation. And that's something else we facilitate here. One thing I will say is that Ken Duque has been really good working with us. We've had a pretty open communication. It's been really nice, and I'm really hoping we can do some good things.
And Joel, Sheriff has offered jail tours to the public. Who's the contact for that, and how should people arrange if they want to do a jail tour?
Have them get a hold of me. That's Sergeant Joel Hensley. It's easier to call and ask for Joel. There's only one of them here. And phone number is 541-247-3320. We have Sergeant John Hensley on the patrol end, and we get confused often. So
just remember Billy Joel.
Yeah. And come up and first call ahead, because depending on the facility and what's going on that particular day, a jail tour may not be possible, but I'll be more than happy to entertain one person or a group. The groups, I don't like to have any more than seven or eight. You saw how big the facility is, it gets kind of hard. But anyways, smaller numbers are good, but have free fill. Anybody can call me at any time.
Great. Thanks, Joel. We need to wrap up. So this has been Joel Hensley, the sergeant and jail commander, Lieutenant Mick Espinosa. At the beginning, we had Sheriff John Ward for a few moments. With me today, Connie Hunter, Jim Newman, and this has been
Curry Matters, KCIW, Curry Coast Community Radio, and thank you, listeners, for joining us.
Thank you.